So I also believe that about the Peace Corps is that it teaches us that we can become part of other cultures. The Latino culture, I call it becoming a Latino by corazón or by heart. Because see, today in the multicultural age, and that's why Peace Corps volunteers are so pivotal to the future, and that is that we need to develop cultural affinity and cultural fluidity.
Welcome to Jobs with Jody. I'm your host, Jody Hammer. Today, I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming best-selling author, multicultural and global leadership expert, and Peace Corps advocate, Juana Bordas. Juana is recognized as a thought leader in the field of leadership, diversity, and social change. She is also an RPCV who proudly served in one of the first groups in Chile, where she worked in production cooperatives, which are, of course, now called microenterprise. And she's also the recipient of numerous awards, including the 2001 Franklin Williams Award through Peace Corps, which was given for her lifelong commitment to communities of color. She's also the founding president of the National Hispana Leadership Institute and the founder of Mi Casa, which is the largest Hispanic serving organization in Colorado. So we're going to hear a lot more about who Juana is and the many amazing things that that she has done. But she's been honored as one of the most influential Hispanics in America by the National Diversity Council. So today we're really going to explore her inspirational career and her journey to become an expert in multicultural leadership and a best-selling author. So welcome and thank you for being here, Juana.
Well, thank you so much. The Peace Corps is so dear to my heart that anytime I can do anything to connect with it, I'm there.
Well, thank you so much.
I served on the National Peace Corps Association board.
Wonderful.
I think it's so important, you know, and one of our goals was to get, finally, we did, a person that would lobby for the Peace Corps up in Capitol Hill, because, you know, wow, the Peace Corps is more relevant today than it's ever been because our generations are so much bigger and they're so global minded. And yet we haven't been able to increase the number of volunteers that the country sends into service. So that was kind of one of my goals. And we were able to at least get one, because, you know, you have to have a lobbyist to promote your issues.
You definitely do. Thank you so much for your volunteer commitment in that regard as well, because, of course, board members are volunteer positions and they're very important positions for Peace Corps to continue being strong and becoming even stronger and growing. So thanks for that. So, Juana, can you go ahead and start by providing maybe a brief overview of your own very interesting career path, you know, where you've been and what you've done in a nutshell, if you will?
Yeah, well, you know, when I returned from the Peace Corps, and the Peace Corps was different for me, first of all, I joined the Peace Corps in 1964. So I was one of the first Peace Corps volunteers, and I actually got to see John F. Kennedy when I was in college. And of course, he inspired a whole generation and also told us that the torch was being passed to us, who were then the boomers. And now my work is to get the boomers to move over so the Gen Zs and the Ys and so forth can take over the millennials. So we're at that same crossroads as when I was a young girl.
Wow.
So it was important to me because as a Latino or Hispanic, and there was no such thing as that until the 1980s. And so I grew up, I like to say, I grew up in a white bread society. You know, I never had a Hispanic teacher or a bus driver or somebody who worked in or owned a big store or anything. I had never seen a Latino in a position of influence. And then I go into Peace Corps. And of course, Chile is an incredible country. And everybody was Hispanic, you know, the president, the head of Land Chile, the airlines, all the business people, all the senators, all the heads of the universities. So it was an incredible experience for me to understand that it wasn't my culture that was keeping my people or keeping other people that weren't. At that point, it was pretty much white male leadership that were keeping us from contributing at the level we can contribute. It was what we call today institutionalized racism and you know, colonization and many things that the younger generation are very concerned about, because the younger generation doesn't approve, I think, of dominance and inequality. We have a very activist generation coming.
Yep, You're right. I think so. Wow. So that was a pretty amazing experience.
Yeah. But when I came back, I actually, and I do want to tell this story because it's such an interesting thing. And we can talk a little bit about the Peace Corps experience. So I came back and I had married another PCV who lived in Wisconsin. Well, you know, I grew up in Florida, so that was sort of a cold place to go. So I had all these papers, but I actually had a portfolio that I put together of things I had done in the Peace Corps. And I went to interview at the Department of Social Services for a job. The guy looks at me and I was so excited about my Peace Corps experience and what I had done doing microenterprise work in the third world and organizing cooperatives and working with very poor women to help them, you know, earn money for their families. And so I thought I could do anything, which is what I want to let the Peace Corps volunteers know. Our experience prepares us to do great things. And so this guy looks at me and he says, "I can see how excited you are and how talented you are." And he said, "But we don't hire anybody here who doesn't have a master's in social work."
Wow.
That's what he says to me at this interview. Well, I had gotten a college degree. My mother had a fifth grade education. I'm the first one in my whole lineage to go to college. So I couldn't even imagine that, right? So I was kind of shocked. And so I put all my papers on his desk and I said to him, "You don't understand. I was born to be a social worker." Oh, this guy looks at me like, "Who is this person?" Right. And he says, "Look," he says, "if you can go down to the University of Wisconsin and get in the Graduate School of Social Work, we'll give you a stipend to go and study if you can work for us." And that is a true story. That if you know who you are, if you know why you were born, if you're gonna have, you know, no one was gonna stand in my way when I was 24 years old. Nobody was gonna stand in my way. And so I went down there and got my master's in social work and came back and worked for them. But the interesting thing about that is I do writing now on finding your personal purpose and finding your what Latinos call destino.
Destiny.
Yeah. And so I say that was my destiny calling me and it wasn't even my idea. So sometimes you get an opportunity or the door opens or somebody suggests you for a job or you get into a certain program or you get promoted or you start an organization and it's your destiny, I think, calling you. And so my career really has been guided by my passionate desire to create a more equal and diverse and fair and just society. But what I do in creating that changes. And the other thing for young people is your career will keep growing, you know, as you serve, as you grow, as you learn, you'll be called to do greater and greater things.
Yep. And it's all a journey. It's oftentimes not that destination, but it's more of that journey that gets you to, That's just as important as the end result.
Yeah. And I think if you're really applying yourself and doing the best job you can, you know, one of my guiding principles is my people deserve my best. And so I'm always trying to do my best because I'm a servant leader. I'm someone who, you know, really believes that I can make a contribution, not because of me, but because of everything that was given to me as a child with my parents leaving their homeland and struggling.
Yeah.
You know, working, my mother scrubbed floors 6 days a week. So I have a real passion and desire to give back, to play it forward. But I think, you know, your career, it's step by step. You don't have to worry. You have to have a vision of what you want to do. But if you do the best job you can, and like for me, you know, serving my people at the highest level I can is what drives my passion.
Right. Yeah, no, that's great. So you got back, you went basically back and got a master's. I'm actually amazed that in those years, at that time, they were requiring a master's.
It is interesting. Well, I mean, I think I was interviewing with a pretty high level person. Yeah. And, you know, when I got out of graduate school, they did hire me and I was the advisor to the Wisconsin Youth Council and did youth work across the state. Nice. So I think they were really looking at a higher level position, maybe.
Sure. That is great. So what did you do after that then? You said you worked for the social services and did the youth work around Wisconsin. Where did your path lead you after that?
Well, you know, my friend Theron, I don't call him my ex-husband, I call him my friend Theron. he's still in Wisconsin, but at the time we wanted to find a place that had the Hispanic culture. We had both fallen in love with the mountains in Chile. You know, that's another thing that happens. You know, your door opens and all of a sudden you're an international kind of citizen. And so we chose to come to Colorado, and I've lived here since. This is my adopted home. And I say that, you know, I'm Nicaraguan by birth, but I'm Mexican by culture because I've lived with Mexican Americans most of my life. And really Mexican Americans, because of the history of our country, where a third of our country was Mexico and they became colonized people in their own lands. They're activists like I am, and they love to celebrate life, all the many colors. And I say, I love my mariachi loving that are Mexican. The dominant culture, and this is my best example of the dominant, the difference between the dominant culture and the Latino culture or multicultural cultures. You know, salsa passed ketchup as America's favorite condiment in the 90s. So that's over 30 years ago. And if you look at ketchup, you know, it's good. I like it on my fries, but the dominant culture is very homogenized. Mm-hmm. It's into conformity. It's into, you know, it's not about inclusiveness and diversity in many ideas. You know, at one point, in fact, you know, it was pretty much white, WASP.
Yeah.
And yet, so you have ketchup, which symbolizes the white dominant culture. And then you have salsa.
Yep.
Each batch of salsa is different. Depends on the jalapeno. It depends on the ingredients. Yeah. But here's the kicker. Salsa Express sells 2,000 kinds of salsa. So that's my metaphor for the global and multicultural age.
There you go.
You can have your ketchup. You can have sriracha.
Yeah.
You can have all that stuff. But it's the idea that there's 2,000 kinds of salsa. There's another thing in our culture, and that is cada cabeza es un mundo. In everybody's head, there's a whole world.
So
people are individuals. They're unique. Yeah. They're a one-of-a-kind design. There'll never be another person like you.
Yeah.
God doesn't make anything twice. And so part of diversity is that whole idea of uniqueness and letting everyone be who they are. You know, young people really like that. They go like, you know, do you.
Exactly.
Do you. Well, you can't do anybody else. Let me give you a little secret there, because you can only do
you. Oh, that is great. Yeah, I loved the Latino culture and just really felt so embraced and so supported. And I mean, I'm still very much in touch with my Ecuadorian Peace Corps family and my host family and my community after almost 30 years.
Right.
But it sounds like it was really formative to you and your own, you know, where you went from there, you know, not only coming back and, you know, getting your graduate degree and working in social services. How long did you work in social services before you moved on to another area?
You know, young people today are kind of in a hurry, you know, and I think they're also used to a technology, which is so fast and so quick and changes so often. And yet really, if you're going to have what I call now my life's work, it's paso a paso, poco a poco.
Yep.
It's a little step by step. And so I am very grateful that I spent until my middle 30s doing community organizing and working, from the ground up, because I think that's what gives me like roots in a tree, a very solid foundation. I understand people. I understand how to motivate them. I understand their challenges. I just worked long enough in the barrios and in our communities to really get a good foundation. So the kind of leadership I teach, part of it is called servant leadership. And the philosophy is that you have to know what people need in order to serve them.
Yep.
It doesn't come from you. It comes from them.
Exactly.
And so back in the late 70s, when I was working in the barrios of Denver, I was working with a lot of Hispanic women, and yet we didn't have an organization. There was no Hispanic women's organization. And, organizations are important because that gives you not only the numbers to have influence, but you can design your own programs. You can figure out. So we did a survey, and Hispanic women wanted jobs. They wanted job training. They wanted English. They wanted counseling. They wanted, eventually we started a business center, which is probably the most popular program at Mi Casa to help them start small businesses. They wanted to do that. And so And then we started high school dropout prevention programs for young Latinos because our kids were dropping out of school. So it's always based on the needs of the people you serve. And that's true even in organizations. If you're managing somebody, what do they need to grow? You know, what are their priorities? What are their challenges? You just need to get to know people and know the organization in a way that makes it real, because you may be right on and you may be the smartest person in the room, but when you have a circle of people, the common wisdom and them defining what their needs are and what they want to do together is really a motivating factor. And then having the patience, you know, to follow that through. Because I stayed at Mikasa 10 years. And wow. I say that as a young leader, if somebody would have told me you're going to be here 10 years, I probably would have left. But but again, it's you do your best job every single day. And then right. things open up for you. So I can tell you how I got into leadership, if you'd like me
yeah,
to
please.
Sort of a segue.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting at Mikasa after 10 years and I realized that I could be there the rest of my life. And yes, right. yes. And Mikasa is the biggest Hispanic serving organization now.
Yeah.
And that we would never solve the problem. So again, it's another step, you know, first I did the work on the ground. I was in the Peace Corps. Then I, yeah. you know, figured out all the tools I needed. Then I helped build an organization. Then I realized that unless the organization was addressing the issues that made all of that necessary, whether right. we're talking about, you know, our work now in gun violence, our work in climate change,
yes.
what drives this, you know, what drives mm-hmm. this? So I'm sitting there thinking about this, and I get the answer that we need to create leaders across this country. We need to change the leadership paradigm. We need yep. to get people in office. You know, there were just 13 Latinos elected to Congress in the last election. 11 of them are under 40. And I'm very excited about that.
Wow, that's awesome.
Maxwell, I did not realize Frost, that. You know, the first Z generation, he's 25.
Because oh my gosh.
I really believe we need a whole new cadre of leaders who are dedicated to a different yep. kind of a society. And so I'm sitting there thinking about this, you know, way back, this is about 1986. This is my destino again, which it's going to happen to you if you keep working and serving. And it was the Adolph Coors Company calling me and saying they wanted to start a national leadership institute for Hispanic women. Because so many of us, and even today, it's still true, we have leaders across this country that are doing great work. And yep. how do we prepare them to be congresspeople and to be heads of organizations and to be school
superintendents? Exactly.
I do a lot of work with Latinos, helping them to become school superintendents and principals.
Nice.
I never had a Hispanic principal, but you know right. the difference that makes for a kid?
Yep.
So it's that kind of idea that I got into leadership because I believe that's where we can have the greatest impact.
And absolutely.
Young people step up.
Absolutely. So you were hired then by them to create this leadership type of institute,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, this leadership institute. Uh-huh.
And it sounds like, from what I recall, it sounds like you then really stayed in the leadership realm, whether, right, you've done a lot in the yeah. leadership realm with different organizations. And now, of course, you know, you've just really been very involved in that. And then when did you become an author?
Well, so I got into leadership about 1968, and then I had a mentor, and I want to stress that for young people. Today, we call them allies. Young people don't really like, you know, one up, one down, and a mentor still somebody who chooses people. Yep. And traditionally, this is the way white males passed on power, by picking uh-huh. their mentees, their proteges, and, you know, but so young people like allies, people that stand side by side
yes.
with you. And I learn as much from young people that I work with as you know, as I hope I give them. So what happened was I got I did an application to the Kellogg Foundation to fund this institute. Mm-hmm. And I got a mentor, and it wasn't the traditional male mentor. It was Dr. Lorraine Matusek, who was in charge of all the leadership programs at Kellogg. And she funded the institute for 3 years, but she did more than that. She took me under her wing. And so she asked me to become what was called a Kellogg scholar, leadership scholar. And I wasn't a scholar. And theoretically, I'm still not, because I don't do original research. Anyway, So I go to this group and all the leadership greats are there. James McGregor Burns, who wrote the book Leadership in 1970, who coined the phrase transformational leaders, that right. If you're a real leader, you will transform your organization. You will transform the people that you work with. And more than that, you'll transform yourself. That leadership is a path to self-discovery and self-actualization. So there were all these great leaders there. And yeah. I get into these tremendous arguments with them. And so finally, they got so tired of this little Latina jumping up and down and saying, no, no, in my community, we stick together. We've done this for 500 years. In my community, our leadership is about social change because we're underrepresented, oppressed people. They finally said, Juana, you need to write.
Awesome.
The Anglo tradition. And these are white males, right? So diversity is not about color or age or ethnicity or race. It's about consciousness. Do you really want to help people? Do you really believe we're all equal? Do you really know that everybody has a gift to give? You know, they said in the Anglo tradition, if you don't write, it doesn't exist.
Oh.
I come from an oral tradition culture.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
So nobody had written a book on multicultural leadership, what it means. Nobody had interviewed our people to see what made them great leaders. Nobody had taken, it took me 7 years. When I talk to real leaders who are young, you know, like Richie Torres, who's the congressman in New York, who's only 34, he says, my life's work is to represent the urban poor, because he grew up as a welfare kid in the projects, you know. Or you take somebody like Maxwell Frost, who his issue is gun violence. Or you take the climate change activist, Jamie Margulies. They all have an issue and they realize it's going to take them a long time to address that. So I would encourage young people to begin thinking that way, you know, to begin thinking, what is my passion? What are my unique gifts? What do I want to contribute? And to understand that, you know, your life does have a purpose, but that it's going to take time to unfold.
Wow, that is great. So what was that book? That was your first book was... Came out when and what was the title of it?
It came out in 2007. And it was, I always wanted to write a Latino leadership book because I am Latina and because it doesn't exist. But yeah. I realized everything is about context, you know, I mean, the environment. And I realized there was no book on multicultural leadership that looked at how underrepresented minority communities in the United States. And I still say this. I would like white leaders to come up to me and say, how did you do it? How did communities of color, through slavery, through colonization, yeah. through imperialism, through being marginalized, through, you know, 47% of Latinos are still still make under $15 an hour. So we have some very refined ways of leadership. We had to inspire people who worked menial jobs. You know, we had to inspire farm workers to get to, you know, to leave the farm and join Cesar Chavez to march for decent conditions and wages at a great risk. We had to inspire people who knew they would never see it in their lifetime. Wow. And that is such an incredible form of leadership. And yet nobody had really documented, like one of the principles in the book is the leader as equal. That we all have something to contribute. It's not about dominance. It's not about patriarchy. It's not about somebody more. Yeah. It's about everybody has a contribution. And we must respect people regardless of their position, regardless of their education, because everyone is a leader in their own right.
Well, and that goes so well with like Peace Corps, right? I mean, that's Peace Corps philosophy too, is that, you know, we go into these communities and, you know, the people that we serve, the people that we're working with, it's about empowering them to help themselves. It's, you know, learning from them. And I think most of us, you know, finished Peace Corps, you know, came back with this sense of, oh my gosh, I was not able to give nearly as much as I was able to receive, as I received. Yes. And Peace Corps is such an amazing wake up call in that regard as well.
Well, and also because the Peace Corps is dedicated to the public good. And that's another thing in communities of color, our leadership. One of my principles is called the leader as the guardians of public values, mm-hmm. and then the leader as community stewards. So guardians of public values means that, you know, leadership is not about the fact that young people today are non-binary. It's not about who you love or what your gender is or et cetera, et cetera. It's about who are you as a person? What are your public values? Do you vote? Do you take care of people? Do you contribute to your work?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, public values are things like our love of democracy and participation. Public values are things like the public good or justice. That's a public value we have in this society, justice and equality. Mm-hmm. That's what leaders should be concerned about, not who your partner is or not what women want to do with their lives. That's right. Individual values. That's the individual deciding, you know, what's right for me. And so in communities of color, we're into the public good and into public values. And those include respect, you know, I mean, think about our society. Pluralism is one of our public values in the Constitution. Yep. What does that mean? It means we should all be working for a society where everybody, regardless of who they are respected equally, right? And so we have these values in communities of color that can revitalize America and that can heal America.
Mm-hmm. And that's what we need, it seems. Definitely some healing here in this country. Thank you, Juana. You're listening to Jobs with Jody. Today, I'm talking to RPCV and bestselling author Juana Bordes. Juana, thank you again for being here. And, you know, we were just talking about your first book, and I'd love to get from you any tips that you might have for aspiring authors, you know, among us, you know, how to get started in writing. I think a lot of us have aspirations. And so what tips do you have for RPCVs who might be interested in becoming an author?
Well, first of all, you know, what my publisher told me is that writing a book is kind of like sewing a quilt. You have all these different patterns and pieces and things. And so the first thing is, you know, you go like, oh, yeah, I'd like to write a book. But right now I'm simply thinking about, you know, my grandmother's kitchen. You write about your grandmother's kitchen because you don't know, maybe that's going to be a piece of another piece, a piece of the quilt, you know, where you come into someone who nurtured you, someone who could do more with less, somebody who was resourceful, somebody who had longevity and really used her life to help her family. And so so that's the first place you need to write if you want to be a writer, and you don't need to worry about, oh, you know, you don't have to start with a big outline, just write your stories or write your experiences or write your thoughts, you know. And so my publisher would say, keep those all in a file and then you can see it. A lot of times the beginning of the book is the end of the book. So that's the first thing, is just to sort of go ahead and write. And, you know, intuition is important as well. We live in a left brain society that, you know, and writing really a lot of times is a right brain creative kind of inspirational thing. And so, you know, making sure that you tap into that sense of inspiration or intuition that you have. But I do want to tell you, first of all, I told you it took me seven years to write the book. And so about year two, I had, and this is volunteerism. I was the vice president of the Greenleaf Center on Servant Leadership. They had published, they published books on servant leadership. So they had a book that was coming out called Reflections on Leadership. And so I talked to the director and I said, I'd like to write a chapter for that, which is a good thing to do. Write an article, write a blog, write, you know. I did. I wrote something called Passion and Power, Finding Your Personal Purpose, that took the Native American vision quest and the Latino love of destino, or the fact that we were all born for a reason. And I'll give you a good example of that. I'm the youngest daughter in an immigrant family of eight. That's why I'm educated. So even the place you're born, the position you're born, dictates what you're going to do with your life. Not dictates, but it kind of opens up things.
Oh, sure.
So anyway, so I wrote that article. And then my publisher, Barrett Kohler, is one of the best publishers in leadership. So I called up the president of, I was able to get a hold of him because of my service on the servant leader. So service opens doors. You meet different boards, you meet different people when you work on an initiative, you meet different people when you work in a school. You know, so I must have talked his ear off because he said, okay. And then they were in San Francisco and I was doing a program, and this is what's called synchronicity in leadership, how things kind of come together when you're on the right path. I was doing a program in San Francisco every year for like 7 or 8 years. And so I would go every year to the publisher with my manuscript and they would say, you have to do A, B, C, D. Go home. I would do it. I would come back.
Oh my gosh.
7 years later, I get a letter from them saying, you said that you would do whatever we said and do whatever you needed to do to get this book published. Congratulations.
You've done it. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. So you just would do it. You didn't get frustrated. You were just like, okay, this is what I need to do. So I'll go back and do it. And you just kept at it with determination.
That's and he asked me a good question. He said, do you want to write a book or do you want to write a good book? And then of course, going back to my thing is that, you know, my people deserve my best. I also got like four or five of my friends to be readers with me. So that's another really good tip is to, you know, have a cadre. Maybe you read each other's writing or maybe you just get them. But I had some leadership experts, some people that wrote, and I wasn't afraid for them to say, no, you got to do this over. When I first wrote the book, I had all the different communities in different chapters. I kind of knew I had to integrate it, but I didn't want to because it was going to be so much work. And my publisher said, you got to integrate this. So you're doing the work for others. You see what I mean? I was integrating that. So the people that read my work didn't have to sit there and go, oh yeah, man,
exactly.
Please do this. Black people do this. And so you have to realize that every word you write, you have to respect the people that are reading it.
Wow. That's powerful. Thank you so much. And you know, speaking of your books, I know you have a recent book that is just, I think you're on your book tour right now and so busy, which is why I especially appreciate you taking time to be with us here today. But can you tell our listeners a little more about what is that book and what is it about?
Yeah, well, I think it's a book that everybody needs to read and that it's, I first wrote about Latino leadership 10 years ago. But it's more relevant today than ever. First of all, Latinos contributed more than half of the growth in the last census for the United States. And we're going to be 78% of the new entries into the labor market. So regardless of where you're going to work, you're going to be working with, for, and managing Latinos. We started 80% of the small businesses in the last decade. Half of our kids are under 16. So this wave has just begun. And so Latinos are a whole different phenomena. And, you know, there's a lot of talk today about diversity, inclusion and talking about race and institutionalized racism. And yet Latinos are not part of that conversation the way we should be because we are the future. That's all there is to it. We are the future. But the other thing about Latinos is that we have a bienvenido spirit, an inclusive spirit, where, like you said, you became a Latina by corazón. We are not defined by race. To become a Latino, you check the box on the census, you self-identify. We're the only group that self-identify. All the other groups is a blood quantum or a blood, how much Black blood do you have, et cetera. And so Latinos offer not only a pathway to join with us in creating this new America, but we actually love inclusion and diversity and bienvenido. You know, like more than 30% of us identify as mixed. You know, more than 25% of us identify as Afro-Latino. We identify as indigenous. I have French blood. You know, we are a mixture and we believe that that mixture has given us our power and that we invite other people to join with us. And I think it's happening because culturally, I think young people, you know, the fastest growing identity with young people is multicultural. And they love it. They want to be part of a multicultural society. They want to tap into all the gifts of the different cultures that make up our country and our globe. And so this is the time for Latino leadership because Latino leadership includes, you know, we're an inclusive community. And beyond that, we're a global community. We're connected to 26 countries. And so as we move into a global multicultural age, Latinos can be the leaders of this new century. And so what I find really exciting about it is that because we're a culture and not a race, people can adopt our values. And some of our values are generosity and hard work and inclusiveness, celebration.
Yeah.
I mean, Latinos spend more money on going out to eat and having fiestas and celebrating. And that's a leadership strategy because the only way we kept coming on and moving on for 500 years is because we celebrate life, you know, and you have to celebrate life, celebrate every accomplishment because the journey is it got a lot of bumps in it.
Yep. So even when it's a difficult along the way, celebrating those like milestones or those places where.
But I think the other thing, especially for young leaders, you know, think about how many books I've read, having been to graduate school and I have an honorary doctorate and everything. Think how many books I've read by white leaders. and by white people. Think about all the people of color who have been to dominant culture schools. And now I give people a lot of credit because they do know a lot about the Black experience now, or at least we're getting more knowledgeable. But how many have read a book on the Latino experience? How many understand, you know, our incredible diversity and our incredible connections and our values and our leadership principles? And how many of them know that our vision is to create this multicultural society? So that's why I would encourage people to read it, because it's kind of a missing link in our educational system today.
Absolutely. No, that sounds really great. I'd love to move into a little bit of maybe some advice you might have. But first, I want to ask you, you know, hindsight's 2020, right? And so looking back, we can always see, oh, that would have been better this way or that way. When you look back on your own life, is there anything you would have changed in your own career if you were able to go back and do it over or change one thing? And if so, what would that have been?
Well, that is a great question. I think, and probably for younger people, I think change is happening faster today. But when I looked at my career at Mikasa, I stayed 10 years. And then I thought that might be too much, you know, because you want the organization to have a life of its own. And then with the Hispana Institute, I stayed 7 years. So, you know, I had some great mentors, but I think the times are changing so much today. And change is so rapid. I wish I would have gotten into an intergenerational perspective earlier than I have today. Today, I'm really conscious about trying to bring the different generations together and for us to learn together. Now, of course, back then we didn't have four generations working side by side. But I think some of the things that I've learned in my career, I wish I would have been able to implement them at an earlier time. For myself, because now I'm 80. Now I have energy and vision, and God
you
has
are not 80.
Yes, and God has blessed me with, you know, with so much passion about what I'm doing. But think about if I were 60.
Oh yeah, you just look and see so
20 years to go. At 20 years to go. You know, so that's why I'm so passionate about young people. They're going to carry this torch forward. They're going to move it forward. And so, you know, my name, I'm on TikTok, by the way, for those that are. Oh, yeah, because I want to have a young father. And my name on TikTok is what's under Juana Bordas, but I do a thing called Tia Juana, which means Aunt Juana.
I love it.
Because in the Latino community, everybody has a tio. In the Black community, they have aunties. And all the communities, like you getting adopted in Colombia, have a way to be part of the tribe, to become part of the community.
Right.
And so Tia Juana for me is my nom de plume, if you want to call it, because I want to be there. I want to be young people's aunts.
Aunt. That is awesome.
I want to stand side by side with them as an ally. I want them to know that I'm a little older than them, so I know some things, but I'm here to support them. I'm here to learn from them. I'm here to help build this society that they're going to live in. You know, I am devastated as to what young people have to deal with today. Whether it's climate change or gun violence or, you know, and people my age that want to retire, I say, no, you cannot retire. This happened on our watch. You have a responsibility to help young people today grapple with the issues. And so that's what I'm committed to. And so I want them all to know I'm their Tia Juana.
Oh, I love that. That is great. So folks who want to reach out to you, of course, can go to TikTok and find
Tia Juana.
I love it. So I guess I would love to hear if you have any maybe advice for or tips for this younger generation that maybe knows that they want, you know, what you have, right? They know they want an impactful career of service, but they're not sure how to proceed and how to really get there. Any tips for people who, you know, want to get there, but just don't know how?
Yeah. Well, you know, I back in the early 2000s, I did a leadership program for some of the returned volunteers. And my purpose with that was to help them see their Peace Corps volunteer as a leadership experience, but not just a leadership experience, because if we're talking about the multicultural global century. What better avenue to prepare you to be multicultural, you know, to be able to connect and learn from and adapt to different cultures, to understand that we're using a small percent of our brain and we can expand to include so many different people and cultures and countries and so forth. But second of all, that it made us global citizens. Yeah. And so one of the things I want Peace Corps volunteers to understand is that their Peace Corps experience prepared them to be leaders. And not only that, they took a step to become servant leaders, which is the highest form of leadership, that leadership that not only, and remember, leadership is a transformational experience. As you give, you also grow. As you transform, you also transform. You build your network, you build your impact, you build who you are, you learn more. And so for Peace Corps volunteers, I really want them to step into that power. Like when I said to this guy, you don't understand. I was born to be a social worker. I already knew that because of my Peace Corps experience, because I had had successes in the barrios of Chile, you know? So give me an organization with some resources and watch this.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. That is so great. So if you were to give, I guess I just want to allow you an opportunity, you know, do you have any final thoughts or final words you want to share with our listeners, with our Peace Corps community here, our Peace Corps family?
Yeah, well, especially for the younger generation, my new book has a chapter on intergenerational leadership called El Círculo or The Circle. Uh-huh. And what young people have told me is that they see themselves as change makers. They see themselves as digital activists. So today, a person like when you asked me about my life, I said, well, I wish I would have known I could have had a bigger impact when I was younger. I didn't know that. Young people know this. They know that you're a hashtag away from starting a movement, you know, hashtag Black Lives Matter, hashtag Me Too, you know? And so when I look at young people today, they say that the ones I interviewed, they were leaders, but they're saying we're change makers. We're digital activists. We believe in dismantling institutionalized racism. We believe in addressing the critical issues that are going to impact our earth and our planet. And so I think, like I said earlier, we're in a new age with young leaders. They're the most educated group. Mm-hmm. They're the largest group. And as Richie Torres told me, the congressman from New York, our generation has a strong ethic of social activism. And so I'm counting on young people, you know, to, you know, I do think we can credit the boomers with, you know, the rise in women and bringing diversity to where it is today. But we have a lot of work to do in order to create the future for these young people.
Yep. Wonderful. Well said, Juana. And with that, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time, your expertise, and especially your passion with us. I could just feel it when we're chatting here, and it's really contagious. So I'm so grateful for you being on the program, and I look forward to reading your book. Absolutely.
You can pre-order it on Amazon today, but I also want to thank you for doing this. We need to keep our Peace Corps network together.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. And that's it for our episode of Jobs with Jody. If you enjoyed today's conversation, be sure to subscribe, share, and rate us wherever you listen to the show. Thanks so much for listening, and make it a great day.